Hello, and thank you for joining the Donut of Destiny. This special episode is sponsored by GE Healthcare. References to a specific product, process, or service by speakers during this podcast do not constitute or imply an endorsement by the Society of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography. The views and opinions expressed do not necessarily reflect those of the Society of Cardiovascular Computed Tomography. Thank you for joining us.
GE Healthcare is glad to be the sponsor for this episode of the Donut of Destiny podcast. GE Healthcare is the leading global medical technology, pharmaceutical diagnostics, and digital solutions innovator dedicated to providing integrated solutions to make hospitals more efficient, clinicians more effective, therapies more precise, and patients healthier. Learn more on our CT solutions on the GE Healthcare website.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to another episode of the Donut of Destiny, the podcast on all things cardiac CT for anyone interested in cardiovascular imaging. My name is Praveen Ranganath, and I'm a radiologist in Dallas, Texas. I'm joined by my co-host, Nidhi Madan. Hi, Nidhi.
Hi, Praveen, and hello, listeners. My name is Nidhi Madan, and I'm a structural interventional cardiologist at Unity Point Health in Iowa.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining us, Nidhi. Today, we have a special industry-sponsored episode. We will be building on a topic that we've covered previously on the podcast, and that is hypoattenuating leaflet thickening, or HALT, following TAVR. Structural imaging, Nidhi. I know that's right up your alley.
That's right, Praveen. And as part of this special episode, we are joined by a pair of esteemed guests, Dr. Stephanie Sellers and Dr. Jonathan Leipzig. Stephanie and Jonathan, welcome onto our podcast.
All right, y'all, before we begin, let's learn a bit more about each of you. First, let's talk about where you're working currently and what your areas of practice are. Jonathan, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, thank you for having me, Jonathan Leipzig. I practice in Vancouver. I'm a radiologist appointed in cardiology as well, and I've been privileged to work closely through the Society of Cardiac CT and join you for some of the Donuts of Destiny. And I'm really excited to have this discussion because my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Sellers, will be joining, and she's taught me so much, you know, about valve degeneration and mechanisms of valve degeneration. And, you know, she joined our team a number of years ago, and she's really led us and the field in understanding how to translate imaging findings into potential mechanisms and really informed discussion. So I'm excited for this.
Wonderful. Thanks, Jonathan. I think that leads naturally into you, Stephanie. Why don't you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Stephanie Sellers. I'm a vascular biologist. I work at St. Paul's Hospital and I'm an assistant professor at the University of British Columbia. My lab here at St. Paul's, the Cardiovascular Translational Lab, focuses highly on mechanisms of degeneration of transcatheter heart valves, including investigating mechanisms of thrombus formation.
Amazing. I think that leads very naturally then into the topic at hand, hypoattenuating leaflet thickening. And I'd like to focus on what it means in terms of the definition of hypoattenuating leaflet thickening on CT following TAVR specifically. You know, when it was first described in, I think, the mid-2010s or so, the structural community suspected that this is subclinical leaflet thrombosis. I suspect that this understanding may be a bit reductive, and your mechanistic expertise here, Stephanie, is going to be key. You have a unique understanding about the pathophysiology of HALT because of your work primarily with explanted valves. Stephanie, could you walk us through your understanding of HALT and if that understanding of subclinical thrombosis is a bit reductive?
Yeah, thanks so much, Praveen. I originally learned about HALT when I did my postdoctoral fellowship with Dr. Leipzig. And I think one of the very first questions I ever asked him was after he showed me a case of HALT on a post-TAVR implant CT. And I asked him, is this just thrombus? What other components make up that hypoattenuating material? And he was very insightful and described to me what he'd learned through years of imaging this phenomenon, but then said, that's a great question. We should look at that on the bench. Perhaps this just isn't plain thrombus. And as a vascular biologist, that led to us doing a number of different studies and experiments on the bench to understand the complex biology that goes into this. And really what we learned there is that all valves as the nature of their material have low grades of thrombus formation on them when we look at them on the bench. But this is a really complex biological process that involves initial laydown of thrombus and then either resolution of that thrombus or eventual organization of that thrombus. And that leads into different phenotypes that we see on these valves as they begin to degenerate on the bench.
Yeah, it's really a great overview, Stephanie. I mean, the journey has been a long one. And, you know, Praveen, as you highlighted, you know, I remember getting the first calls from my dear friend Bjarne Norgaard in Aarhus. He and his team published a paper in Circ Intervention. And at around that same time, there was great work that was coming from Carlos Ruiz and Raj Makkar as part of the Portico experience. And then, of course, building on that in collaboration with the group from Copenhagen, the Resolve and Savory Registry. And so we saw this deluge of imaging that came onto the scene. And really, we didn't have a great deal of understanding of what it was. And, you know, I'm not sure that we always do even now. I mean, there's sort of the classic imaging phenotype where we can say, okay, it's meniscoid, it's thickest at the base, it's thinnest at the tip. So it sort of meets the imaging criteria of HALT. But then it comes into the whole discussion of why it forms, why it resolves, does it lead to valve degeneration? A lot of this work that Stephanie shared back in 2019, I guess, in her seminal JAK imaging paper from the explant work that I think has really taught us that we may have an imaging phenotype of HALT, but the driver of its development and then the downstream outcomes may be driven by a whole number of other factors that we continue to explore, really.
Stephanie and Jonathan, you've both mentioned phenotypes of HALT. Could you go into that a little bit further? Many of our listeners may be familiar with HALT in general, but are not necessarily familiar with some of the substratification of what HALT is.
From a vascular biology perspective on the bench, I mean, it's really sometimes difficult to make correlations between what imagers see as hypoattenuating leaflet thickening and what we see on the bench in terms of what is actually going on in different amounts of thrombus formation or the biology that's driving that thrombus formation. And I'll just give you an example of this, of a question we often debate is, for example, if we see very organized developed thrombus, do we need as much of that to show up on CT as we would an acute thrombus? So are we actually imaging the same type of thrombus and it's all appearing as one imaging phenomenon through hypoattenuation, or can we start to differentiate this? We also know that we can get thrombus formation in different areas around the valve, and how that may play into eventual valve degeneration is a great point of debate. And so then we try and start to classify this on the bench based on where Jonathan, when he reviews imaging, sees different types of thrombus formation in different patterns. And maybe he can describe that more for us a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's a great discussion, Praveen and Nidhi. I mean, obviously, as mentioned, as imagers, you know full well that we want to really clarify to trainees and to the broader field that not everything that is dark or hypoattenuating is HALT, right? I mean, you can have a vegetation, infected or otherwise. You can have pannus. You can obviously have valve degeneration manifesting as calcium. You can have thrombus and valve thrombosis that's more globular in appearance. But really, the classic clinically occult hypoattenuating leaflet thickening that we would see just as our core lab did in the low risk trials in 15 to 20% of patients is really meniscoid, thickest at the base, thinnest at the tip, extending along the leaflet at a varied thickness. We perceive it to be more aortic. Stephanie has taught me that, you know, obviously we don't know what is on the aortic side, what is on the ventricular side is challenging, but it has that appearance. And then of course, as you know, we don't pursue it clinically unless there's a rising gradient or a neurovascular complication or peripheral vascular complication. But I think that this is really speaking to this whole concept of valve degeneration. If you think back to the old surgical days, and yeah, you're not as old as I am. And so, you know, the old days of surgical valve degeneration was just, you know, freedom from reoperation, which is, of course, so naive. You know, I mean, a patient would typically be too unwell to undergo repeat surgery. And so patients died of valve degeneration and they were diagnosed with heart failure and not yet specified. And so I think that the integration of the VARC3 and a lot of the understanding of clinical features of valve degeneration and then the complementary role of exploration thoughtfully with CT has been really helpful in actually improving outcomes for patients, I think, at least in the near term, reducing gradients with appropriate anticoagulation. So I think as CT imagers, we can be proud of that contribution. I guess the real question then now is where Stephanie is exploring, and many others, of course, our friends at Minneapolis Heart and elsewhere, is why do people develop HALT? And if they develop HALT, as Stephanie has taught me and Philippe Pibreau and others, you know, even if we resolve the HALT, have we stopped the potential valve degeneration process, or even with anticoagulation, is it too late? In other words, does the imaging improve, but the injury to the valve, perhaps too lay of a term, but I think the concept is there. Is it already begun, and has that process of valve degeneration already irreparably moved forward?
Yeah, that's a great point, Jonathan. And, you know, the pattern and phenotype that Jonathan describes of meniscoid at the base on explants, we saw that in one study that we published that 50% of the cases on histology corresponded to that phenotype. And the majority of the thrombus was on the aortic side, that it was mostly accumulated at the base, but could extend out to the tip. But I think key points that we've learned from that is that we're also seeing thrombus formation on the ventricular aspect of those transcatheter valves, and that can have variable patterns. And some of the features of the histology suggest to us that that thrombus can form under laminar and turbulent flow. And that leads us to looking further into what kind of factors such as flow patterns and washout that may lead to valve thrombus. And when Jonathan's speaking about how much actual HALT, even if we can resolve it, how does that relate to structural valve degeneration? This is a point that he and I have debated many times, is that when we look at valves on the bench, we always see a small amount of thrombus. And from a biologist's point of view, that means that many cellular pathways are active and could be acting on that valve and leading to eventual degeneration at the subcellular level. And really, that may not necessarily show up on CT. And so a point that he and I have often debated is HALT is resolving, but total leaflet thrombosis is not resolving. And there's two points to that, as he mentioned, is has the insult already occurred to the valve? And then secondly, even if we have resolved HALT, are we just not seeing it on CT anymore and there's a low amount of thrombus acting on that valve?
Y'all are discussing the challenges between the pathophysiology and the clinical approach to HALT, which is obviously our understanding of this is evolving, and y'all two are at the forefront of pushing the science behind this. Nidhi, I want to ask you about a clinical structural interventionist approach from your perspective about HALT in how it portends to downstream structural degeneration. How is it that you approach it in the clinic? And then let's bring in Stephanie and Jonathan to describe it from their perspectives as well.
Yeah, that's a great point, Praveen. And as Jonathan and Stephanie were alluding to some of the phenotypes and some gradient questions coming in. So in clinical practice, I always find myself with some patients who have waning gradients over time. So you keep getting an echocardiogram for several reasons or just as a follow-up, and you find the gradients are changing, increasing, and that sort of worries you whether the valve is undergoing degeneration. Is there HALT? Should we get a CT? And if yes, if we see HALT, is it going to change over time, or once it has occurred, is it going to stay there? So I'd love to hear from Jonathan and Stephanie how they are seeing, if on imaging and on the bench, does HALT change over time? Do you think how it relates to downstream valve degeneration?
I mean, from an imaging perspective, maybe I'll take a stab, Stephanie. I mean, as you know, we can see changes of HALT, and we can see migratory HALT. We can see HALT affecting one leaflet and then the other. We can see it resolve, and then with the cessation of anticoagulation, it comes back. But what I'm learning is, as you know, as a structural interventionalist, is that I don't really want to be traveling around in search of HALT, you know, randomly, right? It's really trying to answer a clinical question. And then where I think Stephanie's work is really fascinating is looking at the structural or the microstructural disorganization of the valve. You know, we see it imaging, Nidhi, as a layering thrombus on top, but why is that happening? And of course, the whole discussion around eccentric valve expansion or under expansion and valve friction or trauma, you know, neosinus washout, all sorts of things. But then Stephanie has also taught us that it's not just a complex physical problem, but probably also a complex biological issue around, you know, endothelial dysfunction or or all sorts of things and words that I hardly understand or can quote. So I'll give it to Stephanie.
I mean, Jonathan mentioned some great points about how things that drive the differing dynamics of HALT and aspects that influence thrombus formation. And I think the three key points that really have been highlighted in the literature and some that we've looked at in my group on the bench is looking at the impact of flow and washout, but then also understanding the patient-specific biology, and that really there's different subsets and different phenotypes of within the patient population that undergoes TAVR. And we really haven't had detailed studies to understand, are these patients, even if we hadn't implanted a TAVR valve, do they have differing platelet biology that drives their risk of developing HALT? And will that cause that pattern of waxing and waning that Nidhi describes? And then just understanding what is the differences in different valve types. TAVR is a field that has rapidly evolved in the last 20 years. We are continuously having different types of valves and different strategies for things like implant depth or post-dilation to look and make sure valves are fully expanded. But at its core, TAVR is largely made up of valves composed of collagen, a factor which platelets are meant to be activated by and form thrombus. And so really, I think something we often look at in the lab is, even if we had the perfect pharmaceutical and we're able to completely inhibit this, is that an actual achievable target? And would that come at a cost of, you know, having to use a very aggressive anticoagulation strategy or a completely different class of biologic to get at that? And really has driven us to ask the question, can we start to target things that thrombus may cause in that valve to cause structural valve degeneration and look at the downstream pathway that occurs after thrombus formation on those valves?
Stephanie, that point is fascinating. I think that in the treatment paradigm for clinical valve thrombosis, anticoagulation clearly has primacy, but there's quite a bit more complexity to this process relative to simple, we'll call it clinical leaflet thrombosis. I wonder if that has manifested in terms of the science of our understanding of the role of anticoagulation in managing HALT, which has yielded some varying results. I was hoping to explore that a little bit further in terms of what sort of pharmaceutical management you would consider for treatment per se of HALT.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different avenues being pursued by different groups in terms of looking at different ways to inactivate platelets or different ways to coat valves or to grow endothelium onto them to make them intrinsically less thrombotic. Really, an area that we focus on is what is the downstream pathway. A lot of work has shown that eventually within about 60 days that those valves will start to fibrose. And we know that infiltration of fibroblasts is part of organizing thrombus and really understanding if that is the part of the pathway that we can start to target. So there's different areas you could get at, but then there's also the approach to look at the long-term driver of eventual valve stenosis is often calcification, and really is the key to understand the nexus at which the thrombus eventually drives calcification and what areas are we seeing in that. I mean, I think we've seen interesting work by Rong Bing and Mark Dweck's group out of the University of Edinburgh looking at activated platelet tracers and looking at thrombus formation on TAVR and SAVR valves. And that may be an opportunity clinically to track this long term, because one of the challenges on the bench is explants are a snapshot in time. And then, or you're in the situation of creating an artificial model, which is difficult to incorporate all aspects of the situation that's going on for TAVR valves in a patient.
That is a great point, Stephanie. And I, on the lines of anticoagulation, I also want to maybe mention some of the clinical side of things I see. As we talked about varying gradients across the aortic valve, we find evidence of HALT or possibly a questionable thrombus. There we treat with a short-term anticoagulation therapy regimen and redo our imaging and find some improvement. And I'd love to know what your thoughts have been in seeing that, or Jonathan, in seeing a follow-up imaging scan, timing-wise or duration-wise. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a clinical perspective, as you know, we repeat imaging oftentimes. We're seeing a lot of underexpansion as well. So, I mean, the mechanisms of gradients are multifactorial. So, obviously, some patients will have HALT and some patients will be underexpanded, and some patients may have patient prosthesis mismatch and only have a modest increase of radiant over time. So the follow-up imaging, we typically do at least one CT to see if the anticoagulation has been effective. And typically, if it's resolved, we don't repeat imaging unless there's, you know, worsening or ongoing concern downstream. We've had some fantastic and interesting results in the core lab, and we look forward to exploring the partner and the Medtronic low-risk data, because that's an unbiased cohort, you know, of hundreds of patients that underwent CT. Granted, it's still only a few hundred patients, but the five-year follow-up will be interesting, right? The incidence of HALT was not insignificant, and the integrity of the follow-up is really quite meaningful. So it'll be interesting to see how those patients do in the setting of HALT, not necessarily the imaging modifying decision-making, but rather, you know, in a non-selected, unbiased fashion.
So our conversation thus far has focused primarily on transcatheter aortic valve replacement. I want to briefly discuss perhaps some of the similarities and differences between HALT at TAVR and a similar phenomenon, but with surgical leaflets. Could you speak to this, Stephanie, in terms of the general ideas about similarities and differences in HALT at TAVR versus that at SAVR?
Yeah, to my knowledge, there's been no study to date that's compared thrombus formation on explants and SAVR versus TAVR. This is often difficult because it's hard to match cohorts to look at on the bench. Certainly from a biological perspective, there's a difference in, obviously, the retainment of the native valve, which can change flow patterns, or removal of the native valve during SAVR, which can potentially, though no one has reported on this, look at inflammation that occurs around the valve. The frame of the TAVR valve can often be thought to activate platelets due to the metal composition of the frame, either cobalt chromium or nitinol, most commonly in balloon expandable and self-expanding valves, respectively. And then we have to think about underexpansion, as Jonathan mentioned, and how that impacts flow. And then the differing positions of the leaflets and the size of the leaflets. So if you have a superannular tall frame valve, and looking at the flow patterns that exist around that, opposed to an interannular surgical valve, which has very different flow patterns that may impact platelet activation. We often see different materials used too. It's far more common for a surgical valve to be made of porcine, opposed to a transcatheter valve to be made of most commonly bovine or porcine pericardium, both of which have potentially different impacts on the biology that goes on in that valve.
Yeah, from an imaging perspective, it's a really important point. I mean, we really have tried to highlight that this is an issue around bioprosthetic valves, of course, not just TAVR valves. There may be a slightly higher incidence of TAVR valves, although I'm not entirely sure that's the case. There's obviously mechanistically, it would be preferable if that was the case, because a lot of our considerations reflect eccentric deployment and underexpansion and residual native aortic valve degeneration and washout and so on. But yeah, I think it's really important to highlight that this is an issue of tissue valves broadly, for sure.
It's a great point, Jonathan and Stephanie. As we alluded to, HALT not being just thrombus, there's definitely more to it, a lot more complex. Could you speak to us, Stephanie, about some of the challenges that you might have seen as you've studied HALT from the perspective of bench research?
Yeah, absolutely. The main challenge of studying HALT from bench research is really creating a model which optimizes your ability to target and understand one part of the pathway that drives HALT or other phenomenons that we observe on these valves that may be observed as HALT. So if we break that down, there's typically about four different ways to go about this, from a pure computational flow analysis, looking at factors such as underexpansion and asymmetrical deployment and canting in different flows. The challenge for that as a scientist is really to come up with a cohort of patients. Often my clinical colleagues do a lot of imaging on patients with rising gradients who have highly suspected HALT, but having a cohort, which is a normal control that's undergone TAVR, is difficult to recruit or justify the conducting that study. The second approach, which we most commonly take in our lab, is to look at explants and look at different patterns of thrombus lay down. We can stain different activation proteins using different techniques, such as immunohistochemistry. We can look at the features of activated platelets using approaches such as scanning electron microscopy. The key challenge there is that explants are a sample of convenience. And I mean that obviously you have to, you're selected out the cohort which has undergone explant of a TAVR valve. And so this is a biased cohort by its very definition. It's also very difficult to get explants. Obviously, this is a low rate of explant currently for the number you would need to look at on the bench, and that requires us to form multi-center tissue repositories. The third approach I would say is to look at platelet biology and look at the differences in that. The key of that is that often is done by groups that are very specialized in looking at different features and pathways that are active in platelets, but isn't usually applied to a situation under flow or to valves themselves. And so it's hard to extrapolate what those changes in biology would result in actual changes of what we see clinically. And then the fourth is to create an ex vivo system in which you try to recreate a halt formation in a biological flow setup. And the issue of that is obviously creating a system that can actually be cleaned and reset and also uses platelets that are specific and blood components that are specific to TAVR patients.
Fantastic. Thank you, Stephanie. That is a perspective that most of us in clinical imaging and clinical cardiology just don't see, and we don't appreciate the nuances and the intricacies that are required in understanding these complex mechanistic components of the science. So thank you. And I want to start bringing us to the close of our conversation, which has been fascinating thus far, and ask both of you what y'all think the most important outstanding questions are that remain in our understanding of HALT. Jonathan, why don't we begin with you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll obviously try to focus on a clinical imaging and a clinical outcomes lens. I think that from an imaging perspective, we really need to explore unbiased cohorts like our experience with the low-risk randomized trials to really see, is there an associated adverse outcome with patients that have imaging HALT? You know, we've seen mixed messaging. I think that at most, the only thing that we've seen with any reasonable consistency is perhaps a slightly higher rate of valve degeneration over time, but certainly heart events, there's no clarity there. And even the valve degeneration, I think it'll be important to explore that. That would be the first thing I would want to look at. And then I think continuing to build on the work, the shared work that Stephanie has highlighted with group from Edinburgh, but understanding the relationship between sodium fluoride avidity at baseline and treatment decision-making. If we assume that valve degeneration is more common in the setting of HALT, the next question is, can we avoid the valve degeneration from progressing, and is anticoagulation enough, or should we be tracking metabolic activity such as sodium fluoride avidity, which seems to be a marker of progressive valve degeneration? Those are the couple of things that I would love to see happen.
Yeah, those are great points, Jonathan. I think from my perspective, we have a number of clinical studies that show an association with structural valve degeneration. There's studies on the bench that suggest that degeneration of TAVR valves is progressive, starting with the finding of initial thrombus on these valves. But really the key mechanistic studies to link is valve thrombus, which shows up as HALT, a definitive driver of valve degeneration, and more exploration into, if so, what are those specific mechanisms and can we inhibit them? And inhibit them in a way that doesn't necessarily use traditional approaches such as anticoagulation and avoid the risk that goes with those kind of anticoagulation approaches.
Thank you, Stephanie and Jonathan. That was an excellent discussion on a very complex topic. Thanks for breaking it down for us in its mechanistic role in clinical world imaging, as well as how we study it from the bench perspective. It's been fantastic having you here and hearing your thoughts on this topic. Any final thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, just grateful for the interest and the opportunity to join you. And I would advocate that the listeners embark on exploring this question as well, because there's a lot of interesting science to be done. And I think a lot of it can be done at distributed sites. You know, you don't necessarily have to have a vascular biology expert or lens, but we can all contribute to advancing our understanding of what this imaging finding means.
Yeah, and I would just thank everyone for listening to our conversation and for the great discussion we've had today. But as a scientist who found a great partner in Jonathan to learn about the clinical imaging part of this, if you're listening and are a clinician, you know, and don't do a lot of science, maybe reach out around you and see if you can build some of those translational partnerships. And if you're a scientist, having clinical colleagues that can really guide your studies on the bench is really impactful for accelerating your work and making sure that it's translatable to provide clinical insight.
Love it. Stephanie and Jonathan, thank you so much, not only just from Nidhi and I, but from the entirety of the community of cardiovascular science. Like, this is such a fantastic contribution to our understanding of this process that affects so many of our patients. So truly, for your expertise and insight, we really, really appreciate you coming onto the podcast. Thank you so much. Of course, to our listeners out there, we hope that you really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, of course, for tuning in. If you like what you hear from us, make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. That helps others out there find this fascinating content on cardiac CT. Once again, this is the Donut of Destiny. Cheers.